In confusion and uncertainty, there emerges a guiding light, a beacon that cuts through the darkness. Welcome to Beacon of Truth with your host, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beacon of Truth. I am your host, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, and you're listening on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. As always, love being here with you each and every weekday. And today we have a very special guest, a returning guest, as a matter of fact, Dr. Andrew Kubik. If you remember the last time we were actually together, he's a bioethicist. And, you know, this is really important, the topics that we're talking about when it comes to these medical and bioethics. You know, technology is changing so fast, the culture is shifting, things are happening so quickly that we can't become complacent, you know, when it comes to issues of medical ethics and bioethics. So today we have Dr. Andrew Kubik is going to be on with us today to talk about, talk about his book, because last time he was on, we got so many questions, we never got around to talking about his book called Transplanting the Womb, A Catholic Bioethical Analysis. Yeah, you heard that right. Transplanting the Womb. You know, so very interesting conversation today. Very much looking forward to that. If you want to join us, we'd love to have you. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com. Again, just a reminder that we have some amazing pilgrimage opportunities coming up next year for 2026. So excited to be traveling with you, and always love traveling with members of the EWTN family. Next year, we're going to be going to Guadalupe, Mexico, with Father Matthew from the MFVA Friars at EWTN. Then in June, Father Patrick will be coming with us to Ireland. And then Father Leonard will be traveling to Japan with us on pilgrimage next September. And then finally, Italy in October of next year for the Eucharistic Miracles pilgrimage as well. So a lot of great opportunities to travel with us on pilgrimage. Just go to my website, deaconharold.com, click on the pilgrimages tab, or just scroll down on the front page. You'll see a huge banner that says Harvest Journeys. Just click on that to download all the flyers and get all the latest information, pricing, dates, everything. And sign up today. Absolutely love to have you with us as we journey to deepen our faith by visiting these amazing locations that will help strengthen us and our resolve to live our Catholic faith with passion and conviction, inspired by the saints and so many amazing people of God who have come before us. All right. And who else is coming before us today are the amazing people that bring you this show each and every day. Who am I talking about? Vanessa Sanchez screening your calls, and Michael McCall doing social media. And of course, our ace in the hole, Ace McKay. Ace, how you doing today, my friend?
I'm good, man. Now, I know you talk about your pilgrimage trip, but you got like a little R&R coming up.
Yeah. You know, our wedding anniversary, my wife, 31 years, we're celebrating this year. You know, last year we went, and for our 30th anniversary, did a train trip across Canada. And this year, we're going to just keep things much simpler and just go to Hawaii for a week.
All right.
So we're very much looking forward to that. Yeah, because we haven't really seen much of each other. I've been traveling quite extensively. You know, I had the pilgrimages to Portugal, Spain, France, Greece, and Turkey.
Yeah.
And then followed up with the international speaking tour in Asia, you know, in Australia, and Papua New Guinea, and the Philippines. And then when I got back, she was gone, you know, at a training in upstate New York. And so we just haven't really spent much time with each other the last few months. And so we're very much looking forward to this this time together in Hawaii. Should be a lot of fun.
That's awesome. We're this weekend, the family, since we didn't get to do the full vacation, we're going to the exotic land of Atlanta, Georgia. So big day at the theme park. Kids haven't been to Six Flags before, so they're trying to overcome their fear of roller coasters. So what better way than to just put them on one? And so we're going to do as many as possible. Because we did Disney a couple of years ago, and they were petrified, especially when we rode the Mummy and there was real fire. My son about lost his mind. He's like, yeah, I'm done. I'm good. Like, he wouldn't get on another coaster with me. I was like, it's not going to burn you. He's like, I don't care. It was too close. I was like, fine. So in the meantime, I'm like, okay, let's not overthink it. We are buckled in. We are for the safety. This is not some, you know, carnival that comes in and out of town. Nothing against carnivals. But, you know, I'm always a little shifty on those because, you know, you take them apart, put them back together. Like, you know, Legos don't always fit the right way every time. At some point, do you lose a Lego? Do you miss a part? You know, so I like the ones that are there all year long. I can ride them as fast and as furious as I possibly can take it.
Yeah, truth be told, you know, I'm not a roller coaster fan myself.
Okay.
You know, it's just that it's just that feeling of like kind of free falling when you go over the top of it.
Sure.
You know, I used to have. I haven't had a dream like that in a long time. But dreams like where you're falling.
Sure.
And you get that feeling of free falling, which is just completely unsettling to me. And so, again, I have nothing against roller coasters. I'm just not a huge fan of riding them. So,
yeah.
I'm not afraid. I just don't like that feeling. There's so many things in life that you can't control,
right.
You know, and that almost feeling of helplessness is being pulled along by the roller coaster doesn't appeal to me. But I see like a, you know, adrenaline junkies or my wife even, you know, she loves roller coasters. She loves that feeling, you know, and so that's where we differ, but it's all good.
So what happens when you go somewhere and there is a roller coaster and she wants to ride it and you're, you know, do you conquer your fear in the moment and just let yourself feel out of control, or does she ride it alone?
We haven't been to an amusement park together since the kids were young.
Right.
I mean, that's really the last time we never go, but just the two of us by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't really think about that. Yeah. The last time we went to amusement park we took the kids there. And we, you know, in Hawaii, obviously there's no amusement parks there, so we won't be riding any coasters there. But I have to ask her about that. You know, if she could be very persuasive when it comes to me. So she, you know, she might be able to get me to ride one if we ever do end up going to an amusement park together.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I'd be open to it, you know?
Yeah.
So we'll see in the moment what happens.
When we were at Disney, we finally had to just split off because there were things I wanted to ride that were going to take a while because the lines are long. And so the kids were like, I don't want to ride any more coasters. So that was about a 2.5 hour window where it was just me and Disney alone. So, and I was okay with it because I got to ride all the things I wanted, came back with all the stories. I'm like, you missed out, you know, because here's what happens. And I think we do this oftentimes in life experiences, not just coasters, but we either Google or talk to people who also have the same fears of, oh, well, if you ride this, it does this. And there's three corkscrews and you're upside down for 20 seconds. And, you know, all the things that only make it sound scarier. And, you know, and not to say that if you're scared of roller coasters, you're not, you know, strong in your faith. But to me, I make that connection. I'm like, Lord, help me conquer this fear. Is it a coaster? Is it a thing that's out of my control? Because I don't want to be afraid, right? That's the whole purpose of life, is just to enjoy it to the nines and then be safe when I know that I can be and should be. But when it's just a matter of a thrill of an experience, I don't want to miss out on that opportunity just because, well, what if, you know. Or to put my even fears on the kiddos, if they wanted to really ride something like new, you know, like I have a partial, I'm not afraid of heights, but like when I'm on a coaster, I never look up because that's when I have that like feeling of, oh, I feel like I'm falling, you know, but I get that little bit of vertigo kind of moment. So I just make sure only look down or look straight ahead, right? Enjoy the view. You're up atop. Here comes the drop. And so I don't know. I don't like to let my fears consume me, even if it is just a silly roller coaster.
Yeah, you know, and I've often said that I think some of the greatest ideas in human history are in cemeteries, because people were so afraid of allowing, you know, something that may have been inspired by God to see the light of day because of fear.
Sure.
Right. They were fear of failing. They were a fear of disappointment. Their fear of what other people think. There's so many different things they question and doubt. And that again, that brilliant idea that was inspired by God never sees the light of day, because God's not going to force you.
Yeah.
You have to cooperate with His will. And when that's why 1 John 4:19 says, "Perfect love casts out all fear."
Amen.
So you're absolutely right. It's about and life is a roller coaster, up and downs and twists and turns. We have to navigate that by overcoming our fear with love.
Yeah, that's so true.
That's the way we do it. All right, my friends, Dr. Andrew Kubik is our guest, bioethicist, talking about issues in bioethics, but particularly his wonderful book where he talks about transplanting the womb. Send us an email today, my friends, beacon@ewtn.com. Yeah.
There's a double kick that you love.
Yep. Man, I love listening to drummers. Yeah. I'm just not that coordinated. I don't think to be able to, ride cymbal, double bass, snare, yeah. With a regular time signature, that's what, even with odd time signatures, it's just like,
Yeah.
I don't think my brain just works that way,
Sure. Well, I feel the same way when I watch a guitarist, I'm just like, just give me some strumming and, a little bit of something, but I don't, the fast fingers is, I'm like, total awe.
Yeah, and it does, that does take some practice, especially to build up the speed like that.
Yeah.
But shredding, it can also be fun as well. I just wish, every time I listen to something awesome like that, the music you just played to me sounds kind of like a dream theater kind of thing, like a Prague kind of thing. But I just love that. It just makes me want to play, get the guitar and just
as music
plug it
should.
In. Yes, absolutely. Inspires you to greatness, I tell you. All right. I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sibbers, listening to Beacon of Truth. And today we have a very special guest, Dr. Andrew Kubik, a bioethicist who's going to talk to us about his awesome book, Transplanting the Womb, a Catholic Bioethical Analysis, today on Beacon of Truth. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com.
Well, making it easy for you to stay in touch with what's happening from week to week, EWTN News Wings email comes directly to your inbox, and you can find out more about great shows and things available in the religious catalog and just what's happening so that you really don't have to guess or try to catch it. You just know. So sign up today. Easy to do at EWTN.com when you subscribe to Wings.
All right, my friends, it is now time for the Soulful Psalms segment of Beacon of Truth. The Soulful Psalms, we take one of the Psalms from the Book of Sung Praises from the Wisdom Literature of the Old Testament that we hear in each and every holy sacrifice of the Mass. There's always Psalms there. And we connect that Psalm to your everyday lived experience. Well, today we're going to continue our look at Psalm 68. Psalm 68 is in book 2 of the Psalms, and in that book, Psalms 51 to 72 are all attributed to David. All right, and today we're just going to take a look at a couple of verses, starting at verse 16. But the prescript or superscript of the Psalm says in Hebrew, Lemenzeach ha-David mizmor shir, for the choir master of David, a psalm, a song. Right, so what does this tell us? So David wrote this psalm, gave it to the choir master, and we see a list of the superintendents of the Musical Guild of the Jewish Temple in 1 Chronicles 15, 16 to 22. You can see a list of all of those members of the Musical Guild. This is obviously a psalm and also a song. Why? Because the psalms were meant to be sung. This was part of the Jewish hymnal. And so... So he started off, "Let God arise, let his foes be scattered. Let those who hate him flee from his presence." All right? So again, he's calling upon God for aid and assistance. And so we see verse 16. Again, David loves using metaphors, loves using images of nature and created reality in order to express his challenges, his connection with God. So he says, "You, mountain of Bashan, are a mighty mountain, a many-peaked mountain, the mountain of Bashan." So what is he talking about here? So Bashan is a biblical name for the northernmost region of the Jordan. It's situated between Jordan and Syria. It's called the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights. That's what it's called today. But back then, this was called kind of the Transjordan region of Israel. Again, in the northern part. And so Bashan is a mountain range in that region. And so why does he bring up this particular mountain range, this many-peaked mountain? Look at verse 17. "Why look with envy, you many-peaked mountain, at the mountain where God has desired to dwell?" Right? So God has desired to dwell in the mountains of Jerusalem, right? The holy city. Or the heavenly name for Jerusalem is Mount Zion, right? So that's the mountain. And so he's saying, look how jealous you are. You are a many-peaked mountain. You are a mighty mountain, Bashan. You know, you are in that northernmost region. In a sense, you're higher. But why are you looking with jealousy at the mountain where God has desired to dwell? And he says, it is there that the Lord shall dwell forever. Right. And so the connection that I'm thinking of here when I read this psalm is that we have so many people who are trying to place themselves higher than God in our culture today. You know, we look at, for example, the Tower of Babel. Right. They tried to build a tower to try to reach God. Right. And of course, which they couldn't. We have so many people today are putting themselves above above the ethical considerations when it comes to medicine, or they put themselves above the natural moral law, which they ignore because they think the law within they're a law unto themselves, they're a reality unto themselves, and so they're talking about the jealousy here, right? So they look with jealousy upon Christians, believers in Jesus. You know, who hold themselves to a higher standard, to a heavenly standard, to a godly standard, and not to the standards of the world. And so we are the ones with which God has chosen to dwell. Why? Because the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, as it says in John chapter 1:14. So we shouldn't have to fear the culture. We shouldn't have to look with envy on the culture. Because the culture is actually looking with envy on us, right? The culture is the one that should be looking to us for clarity and for direction. Not relativism, not truth is whatever they decide to be, but truth ultimately is a person. It's a dynamic relationship with the living God and the person of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. All right. And so with that, we now bring on our guest, Dr. Andrew Kubik. Again, he's a return guest. We had him on a few months ago. Very, very popular show. Tons of calls. We got so many calls, in fact, that we never even got to the topic that we were supposed to talk about then. So I'm bringing him back to talk about his awesome book and a very interesting discussion I think we're going to have today. So Dr. Kubik is the deputy director for the National Center for Religious Freedom Education. And is a research fellow in bioethics and medical conscience at the Religious Freedom Institute. He serves as a personal consultation ethicist for the National Catholic Bioethics Center and an adjunct instructor of bioethics at the University of Mary. And he just published a book that we're going to talk about mostly in the next segment of the show, Transplanting the Womb, a Catholic Bioethical Analysis, published by Catholic University Press. So really interested in diving into this topic today. And so joining us now is our special guest, Dr. Andrew Kubik. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Kubik. Great to have you with us again.
Deacon, it is a pleasure to be with you. I wish we were in person, but I'll take over the phone line any day with you.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. And so so what's going on what's the latest going on in the culture today with issues of bioethics or medical ethics? Like I said, things are changing so fast. The culture is changing so fast. There's all these emergent technologies, and now there's AI playing a role in all of this now. So what are some of the things that we can't take our eyes off? We can't take our eyes off the ball as Catholics as we, you know, are seemingly inundated, almost to the point of being overwhelmed by all the changes in our culture and with these emergent technologies. So what should we continue to be aware of when it comes to issues of bioethics?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as you said in the intro, it's a world that's always changing. It's very dynamic. And so as a bioethicist, really to keep your finger on the pulse and to just see the news as it pours in, even some topics that were not necessarily on the fore have returned. So I'll give you one example. In vitro fertilization has always been a conversation, artificial or assisted reproductive technologies. It was part of a conversation that we would have as an ethicist to talk to people about, for example, the morally appropriate or illicit restorative reproductive medicine, or the assisted technologies that assist rather than replace the conjugal act. So recognizing in vitro fertilization is immoral. Well, this all came really screaming ahead once we had our president say that he wants to be the IVF president. And we're seeing more and more IVF conversations and policy wanting to open that up, wanting to have that funded. So IVF has certainly returned to be a point of conversation towards the front. Another point of conversation that I see happening in bioethical circles is on brain death, what some people call the neurological criterion. Going back to 1980, we had the cardiorespiratory or cardiopulmonary determination, so when the heart stops, when breathing stops. But in 1980, we had the brain death enter in as one of the two now options to determine somebody to be deceased. Well, there are a lot of bioethicists, philosophers, scientists, and physicians who are starting to question whether or not the protocols that the AAN, the American Academy of Neurologists, have set forth, whether that's sufficient to actually test whether or not, this is the definition they use, irreversible cessation of the entire brain, including the brainstem, whether or not the current protocols are sufficient. So that's another one. And then the other one I'll tell you to keep an eye on too is embryo adoption. And when I say embryo adoption, I actually like to offer a little bit more clarity and say embryo rescue. So the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, what is now the Dicastery, but when they were the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, they came out and said that embryo adoption as a treatment, even though it's not a treatment, but as a treatment for infertility is immoral. But there's a lot of questions about, can it be a rescue operation to save frozen embryos that have been abandoned by parents? The National Catholic Bioethics Center, who published my book, they also just came out with the second volume of a book on embryo adoption / rescue, in which they had authors, several authors, come in and talk about this technology and whether it can be or whether it is not moral.
Wow. That's really important. We got to have a whole show talking about that. I mean, that's huge. Well, thank you for that amazing overview. And when we come back, we're going to continue to talk with Dr. Andrew Kubik, particularly about his book, Transplanting the Womb, A Catholic Bioethical Analysis. Would love you to be part of the program. Send us an email today, beacon@ewtn.com. Right. Wow. Talk about contrast in musical styles.
Keeping it fresh. It's a lot on the buffet.
Yeah. Just lazing on a Sunday afternoon, I tell
you. That's right. I know we still got a ways till the weekend, but you know, it's summer, right? You still can enjoy that a little bit.
Yeah, sitting back, sipping your cold lemonade there or iced tea on the porch, just chilling. That's right.
Or you could combine them, have an Arnold Palmer, you know, make it live your best life.
There you go. Love that. How awesome is that? I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, listening to Beacon of Truth. And today we have our very special guest, bioethicist Dr. Andrew Kubik, that's going to talk to us about his awesome book, Transplanting the Womb, A Catholic Bioethical Analysis. Today on Beacon of Truth, would love to have you with us. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com.
Well, of course, if you missed Wacky Wednesday earlier today, Women of Grace on course tonight. You can check that out right here on EWTN so that no matter where you are, 3 a.m. Eastern, you're making sure that you're getting kind of your touch of what's happening in the supernatural. And, of course, Sue Brinkman joins Johnette Williams for Wacky Wednesday every Wednesday here on EWTN Radio.
All right. You listen to Beacon of Truth, and our special guest today is Dr. Andrew Kubik. He's a deputy director of the National Center for Religious Freedom Education and a research fellow in bioethics and medical conscience at the Religious Freedom Institute. He's written an awesome book, Transplanting the Womb, A Catholic Bioethical Analysis, with Catholic University Press. And the book is basically an extensive account of the ethical ramifications of uterus transplantation. Very interesting topic. So, Dr. Kubik, welcome to Beacon of Truth. And tell us, why'd you write this book? And what we're talking about transplanting the womb, because we're all familiar with the idea of transplants, right? There's a heart-lung transplant, right? In fact, my wrestling coach in high school had like a liver transplant or a kidney transplant, or, you know, we're familiar with the idea of transplants, but specifically you're talking about transplanting the womb, uterine transplants. Like, how does that differ from the other transplants that we're often familiar with?
Yeah, great question. So going to your first, this was not on my radar. This was not a topic that I knew anything about. I don't even want to say I knew much about it. I knew nothing about this topic. But I was a doctoral student preparing to submit my proposal for my dissertation at a school in Rome called the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum. And I was going for a PhD in bioethics. And so I was praying and talking to others about a topic to choose. And through the grace of God and his providence, I was able to connect years before and develop a relationship, a working relationship, a personal relationship, a professional relationship with, I think, one of the foremost bioethicists in the world. His name is Father Nicanor Ostriaco. He's a Dominican priest. He has a PhD in biology from MIT and does cancer research. He has his sacred theology licentiate. And, you know, he has all of these accomplishments. He has the number one best-selling bioethics book for Catholics, and that's called Biomedicine Beatitude, now in its second edition, also from CUA Press. And he reached out to me from Rome when he was at a meeting with other moral theologians and ethicists and said, we're talking about areas that the church hasn't really dug deep into, hasn't really done a tremendous amount of research. There were some articles Father Ted Pahalchis, Sister Renee Merkies wrote about womb transplants, but they didn't have an in-depth investigation. And so he said, I know what you're doing. And when God speaks through Father Nicanor, I listen. And so I said, okay, Father, that's what we're doing. Let me dig into uterine transplants. And so I'd spent about 5 years, because I was doing that part-time. I was also working, and God, hopefully being a good Catholic husband and father to my family, but I also was trying to complete this doctoral program. And so through the course of about 5 years, I learned everything I possibly could about uterine transplants. And that's where the dissertation was. And also the dissertation was updated with regard to the science and then became the book. Yeah. Second question you have about how does this differ? Well, I mean, when you look at a transplant, you have really three different areas of transplantation science. You have the procurement, you have the testing. Sometimes testing happens before, sometimes it happens after. If, for example, the donor is deceased. And then you have the actual donation, the receipt, the reception of the organ. And so in those ways, it looks very similar because you have either living donors or deceased donors. And you heard that right, living donors as well, who can give up their uterus. It'll be tested either beforehand or after to make sure that it will not necessarily be rejected. And of course, there's immunosuppressant medications to ensure that rejection doesn't occur, that it's less likely. And then the actual transplant itself into the recipient. So in that way, it's similar. But what makes it have a different ethical layer, if you will, is the fact that it's not a vital organ. And so when you look, for example, at a heart, when you look, for example, at lungs, and I even make the argument, and I know some people don't, I make the argument that even a kidney is a vital organ. I make that argument because we need kidneys. Some people say, well, it's a more of a quality of life transplant because there's always dialysis and they could choose that rather than undergoing. But I think the actual matter that we're dealing with is vital. We can't live without kidneys. And there are reasons why somebody can view dialysis as extraordinary and morally optional and move to the other option. But with the uterus, never discounting the importance of the uterus and making women feel, for example, many women report that the presence of the uterus brings on that feminine character or makes them, just really relish and marvel at the feminine genius that existed in God's design. Absolutely, it's part of the physical integrity of woman, but it's not necessary in terms of their vital function. In other words, they can live without. I don't know if you know, I certainly do know women who have had therapeutic hysterectomies for whatever the reason may be. They're living a very healthy life now that whatever the pathology was that was in their uterus, now that that's been removed, their health has actually been restored. And so one of the aspects to uterine transplants that took on that additional layer was the fact that it's non-vital. And then, of course, you also have other aspects too, which I'm sure we'll get into, one of which is the requirement, the absolute requirement. Every single trial to date, and what I'm reading is there's nothing changing in the foreseeable future, that IVF must occur before the removal of the uterus from the donor. There must be frozen embryos before the uterus is removed. So IVF is a key component to this process. That's another area that was, like I said, an additional layer of the ethical analysis.
Wow, fascinating. I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. You're listening to Beacon of Truth, and today we're talking with Dr. Andrew Kubik about his awesome book, Transplanting the Womb, about uterine transplants on Beacon of Truth. Would love to hear from you today. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com. So I want to follow up with you, Dr. Kubik, on two things. First, right now, okay, let me do the second question I was going to ask first. Who are the ones that would donate a uterus? So we're talking about, this is not like donating plasma or giving blood, or even one of my very, very close friends, who I've literally known him since kindergarten. He donated one of his kidneys to his mother about 20 years ago. And he's had no, I mean, he actually only has one kidney, right? Because his mother, who's still living, and the reason why she's still alive after all this time is because of that kidney that she received from her son, and so we get that, but who would want to donate their uterus? I mean, are we talking about women who've decided not to have children, or could a woman donate a uterus who, it's because, okay, we're done having kids and I don't need this anymore, so I'm going to donate. I mean, how, what does that process look like? Like, how are those decisions made?
Yeah, well, it's actually both. It's often what we see in the research is it's actually relative of the recipient. So one of the first cases that we know of was a mother who donated her uterus to her daughter, and there was an article. It said a uterus bridging three generations from the mother to the daughter, and then of course the child who was conceived prior to by way of IVF but was transferred to that transplanted womb was born in the grandmother's womb. By all accounts, by the logic of it. So we do know that many times it's a relative. There is one case that I'm aware of in which we actually have an identical twin that donated her uterus to her identical twin, which actually is a fascinating case study because they're identical twins, the recipient didn't need immunosuppressants because it was a genetic match for her. But outside of a relative, it's altruistic donors. It's women who, you asked a great question, have they completed their own reproductive journey? They don't have to have completed it. It's a preference that the women are either have signed off saying that they're no longer desiring children, or even that they've completed menopause and the uterus is no longer functioning for them. You also have cases, now these have not necessarily been actualized. In other words, they haven't been put into use, but there are a lot of questions about whether it's morally appropriate, or I shouldn't say morally appropriate, whether ethical in the secular setting for a woman who identifies as a man who is going through the trans surgeries, whether or not since they're going, if they perform a hysterectomy as part of that series of surgeries, whether or not that uterus can be donated.
Oof.
And that's actually its own ethical question. Many of the secular sources say, yeah, perfectly appropriate. It's just going to go to waste. We in the Catholic world are deeply concerned about the harm to the donor, and in a number of ways, including a hysterectomy that's unnecessary. So, we also have people who have signed up to be deceased donors after they've been declared dead. And we do now have examples of success. When I say success in uterine transplants, a success is not that the uterus stays in the recipient, not that there's any signs of rejection. Those are all positives, but the real success is measured by one to two children who were gestated in that uterus. The most children who have been gestated are two children, and then they'll perform a final hysterectomy to remove the organ and discontinue the immunosuppressant regimen. So deceased donors can also donate. They have to just go through extra steps because it's considered a special type. It's called a VCA or a vascularized composite allograft. It's like a hand or a face transplant, so it requires special permissions, but that's also a possibility too.
Oh, gosh, I got so many follow-up questions. I'm not familiar with the biology, but so a woman who is deceased or a woman who's gone through menopause, the uterus is still viable then? I mean, I guess this is showing my ignorance here when it comes to women's physiology, but so that can still be used?
It can be, yes. Actually, in the Catholic world, my analysis and my predecessors, like Sister Renee, said if, so for example, let's say there is natural conception and IVF is taken off the table. If this is going to be a morally permitted procedure, it must be from a postmenopausal woman. It must be from a postmenopausal donor. We can't upset, unless it's necessary for the donor, to completely eliminate the functional integrity of her reproductive system. You bring up a great point, and it helped. It's such a great example to marvel in the magnificence of God's design of the human body. You bring up the kidney. Well, I mean, we have two kidneys. We lose one. The math tells us 50%, but it rebounds 60, sometimes even 70% of our renal function. It's amazing how the body works. But once the uterus is removed, there's no longer the ability to gestate a child. So the reproductive function has permanently ceased. And so there, when we talk about premenopausal, our mind would automatically assume that, well, this is a healthy uterus that can be transplanted. But as long as there's adequate blood flow, and they will run tests to make sure that the uterus, passes their screening, but as long as there's adequate blood flow, which continues after menopause, just the hormone function and ovulation, et cetera, ceases, it's still viable. With regard to a deceased donor, they have the doctors, the physician scientists, they have only a few, just about an hour or so to remove that uterus, and they can keep it cryopreserved. And the evidence suggests they can keep it cryopreserved for about 24 hours. Because remember, when somebody is declared dead, they haven't prepped the recipient ahead of time. They're making the phone call. They're telling a recipient to rush to the hospital, prepare for surgery, a very invasive surgery. So they need a way to essentially preserve that uterus, and they actually cryopreserve it. They provide different solutions and in a way, on the back table, preserve it in that solution so that it remains viable, at least for several hours.
Wow. Gosh, I'm Deacon Howard Brooks. We're to talk with Dr. Andrew Kubik. I'm just like blown away by this. So many things going through my head. This is a really interesting topic, talking about uterine transplants. It's a topic that we don't talk very much about in the ch church. And so we're grateful to Dr. Kubik for his book, Transplanting the Womb, A Catholic Bioethical Analysis. On Beacon of Truth with your host, Deacon Harold Burke-Sibbers. Would love to hear from you. Send us an email, beacon@ewtn.com. Now, I just a couple more things here. Well, three questions I have in my mind. First of all, does the immunosuppressants that are given, well, as with any transplant, right? But with particularly with the uterine transplant, does it affect the child? Is there any studies that show like what those immunosuppressive drugs and the effect it may have on the developing fetus inside that transplanted uterus?
Those are really good questions. We know from decades of evidence, as you noted, that recipients of a kidney or a liver can be immunosuppressants and can become pregnant. And the outcomes, the health outcomes of those children seem to be on par with children who are born in a non-immunosuppressed mother, so in a woman who's not on immunosuppressants. So there does seem to be a safety component. Now, I will tell you, and I won't get into too much detail here, but there are a variety of immunosuppressant drugs. Some cannot be given while pregnant. Some are considered safer. Every immunosuppressant drug that I've seen has at least the risk. In other words, there's always the concern or the risk that it could affect, but there are some that they know that they have well-published documentation that it'll affect the child in the womb in utero. And so in those cases, those have to be discontinued when pregnancy occurs. However, there's other ones that they can be used in their place. When we
Oh,
talk
okay.
about, when I talk about the ethical analysis of uterine transplants, we're looking at the action, right? We're looking at the action of the physician scientist, of the donor, of the recipient. We're looking at the action of creating by way of IVF. But we pray for the health of all of our brothers and sisters, including the children who are conceived, right? And so there's children who were conceived by way of IVF and transferred to a transplanted womb. I pray to God that we see decades and decades of health from them. And so far, the oldest child born from a uterine transplant is 10 years old. And we do see everything that's at least been published. We do see that the child remains healthy. So we can only go by, because this has been around since, that child was born 2014. I think he will turn 11 in the fall. But I mean, this has been around since 2014. So we only have that body of evidence. And so we're following, and I'm praying to God they're healthy, but we also want to be very careful to assess the health of these individuals to inform the women who are considering going through this that this is a possible outcome. So praying they're healthy, and so far the children who have been born while the mother is immunosuppressed in a transplanted womb have been healthy, but it remains a concern.
And that brings me to my next question, following up on what you just said. So when a uterus is transplanted into a woman, can she conceive through natural intercourse, or is the only way that womb can receive a child is through IVF?
No, that's another good question. So the only way to receive a uterus, the only way to be a candidate, is if you have embryos already frozen. So from a
Oh, I see.
logistics standpoint, if a woman wanted to receive a transplanted uterus and she went in saying, "Well, I want to naturally conceive," she couldn't be a candidate.
Oh,
They,
I see.
the physician scientists have said, and this goes back to the first case in which a uterus was transplanted, but no child was born from it, back in 2000, Saudi Arabia. Then in 2011 in Turkey, there was a biochemical pregnancy, which means a positive pregnancy test, but the child passed away. And then, as I said, in 2013, actually 2012, 2013, leading to the success in 2014 in Sweden, we do see those cases, but all of them required IVF. And the physician scientist said, this way we have control over it. Because if time is of the the essence. In other words, if we want to reduce the amount of time this woman's on immunosuppressants, if she doesn't have to be, remember, non-vital organ, then why risk not conceiving by way of natural conception? In other words, if natural conception takes 6 months, a year, 2 years, that's additional time that that woman is going to be on immunosuppressants when the doctors say we can just simply place a uterus, transfer it into the womb, and pregnancy will occur 9 months later, C-section. By the way, all children who are gestated in a transplanted womb are born via C-section. Regarding natural conception, I have not seen that conversation had other than ethicists who come from the either ethical or moral point of view that IVF is immoral or inappropriate or unsafe, whatever it may be. Besides those few, myself included, it's going to be IVF.
Wow. So then I guess that begs the question, and maybe part of your conclusion, is uterine transplants ethical? Because if the only way to conceive is through IVF, which itself is immoral, for us as Catholics, then can the practice of uterine transplant then be considered an ethical practice since it is a vehicle for, the only way that that can happen is a process that is unethical. So.
So, unless we parse out the steps, unless we say, well, this is one step, two step, three step, four step, if you look at the entirety of uterine transplantation requiring IVF, then it muddies, it makes immoral the entire process. Part of my book was to, and part of my dissertation, the book that followed, was to speculate, well, what if, what if, what if? And so, what if we talked about this in the first segment? What if the church, the Holy Mother Church, comes out and definitively says embryo rescue is morally permitted? Could that happen? Because now we have the transfer of an embryo that's being rescued to a transplanted uterus. So IVF is not required. Again, this is all speculation. There are a few technologies that the Catholic Church has not officially approved nor condemned. So gamete intrafallopian transfer, as long as certain steps are taken, as long as certain boxes are checked, for example, how the sperm are acquired, the church has not outright condemned that. So I went through all of these. I even looked at what can you transplant, because we do have cases. There's a case right now in the South of a woman who was declared brain dead while pregnant, and they're keeping her corpse animated, or if you do not believe brain death is death, keeping her alive till they get that child to the gestational age of 26 and a half weeks for an emergency C-section in the NICU. If a woman is declared brain dead and she's pregnant, I even considered, can they take an impregnated uterus and put it into a recipient? So I went through all of these, but again, speculation. I do not see any signs that IVF will not be required. I think it's going to be required part of this process for the foreseeable future.
Wow, this is just a fascinating topic, and I'm so glad we're talking about this because, yeah, this is one of these areas that I mean I don't think I've ever really heard this be spoken about in any major Catholic bioethical circles, at least for the general public, the general faithful.
And
So this is just
Deacon, we really have
fascinating.
to have this conversation too, because if you look right now, we have at least 100, some have reported 135 uteri transplanted. We've had over 50 children born from these transplanted uteri. And the reason I say we also have to know, not only for the wider community, but the United States now leads the world in uterine transplants. Baylor University Medical Center leads the world in transplants, in uterine transplants.
Wow, really? I did not know that. Wow, that's fascinating. So in a couple minutes that we have left, what else about this topic that maybe we didn't discuss or a question I didn't ask that people should know about your book and about uterine transplants?
Yeah, no. Let me see if I could summarize it all in a minute or two. But one of the things I think is very important is you mentioned IVF and how IVF morally muddies the entire process. But if we look past IVF, and I kind of gave you a few examples of where it could be morally permitted, at least by way of conception, there's also an imprudence factor. And I want to just draw that to your audience's attention. There's an imprudence factor where every uterine transplant requires immunosuppressants, the transplant procedure itself, at least possibly two high-risk pregnancies, two cesarean sections, and a final hysterectomy. All very serious procedures.
Yeah, yeah, wow. All right, well, thank you for being with us today, Dr. Kubik. And remember, you can stream today's show by visiting podcastcentral.ew10.com/radio. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits. And until we're together again, my friends, may Almighty God bless you, keep you, and protect you. The Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.